the British crown. Who keeps the metric system down? We do. We do.
Who leaves Atlantis off the maps?
Who keeps the Martians under wraps?
We do. We do. Who holds back the electric car? Who makes the Gutenberg a star?
Fish of their sight.
Who rigged every Oscar night?
We do. We do.
Hello again. This is the third segment of my interview, The Visigoth, with Eric John Phelps, the author of Vatican Assassins. I want to remind you, you're listening to DC Community Radio, and this is yet another segment of The Grassy Knoll. When we last left off, Brother Eric, we were talking about the Jesuits in flight. They did flee to the United States. But before we jump across the pond, is there not a figure that is kind of prominent in the Jesuit-European situation by the name of Adam Weishaupt?
Sure. When the Jesuit order was suppressed in 1773 by Pope Ganglionelli, or Pope Clement XIV, when they were formally suppressed, all their property confiscated, and they were forbidden ever to teach or to be ever revived once again, the Jesuits then went underground. And under command of their general Ricci, that they could never cease to be Jesuits because of their vows. So one of the things they did was to foment the French Revolution as payback for their expulsion from France in 1764. And to foment that revolution, they created a secret society called the Bavarian Illuminati. And the man who was chosen to do that was a German Jesuit. He was not Jewish. He was a German Jesuit named Adam Weishaupt. He was a teacher of canon law at Ingolstadt University. And we must remember, for all the conspiracy historians, that it was illegal for a Jew to be in the Jesuit order pursuant to a statute that had been passed in 1593 as a result of Diego Laynez being a Jew and the second Jesuit general. So Weishaupt was not a Jew. Weishaupt was a very German name. You find it all throughout Germany. And so Weishaupt started the Illuminati, and it was the tool by which the Jesuit general would foment the French Revolution and also to link up with the House of Rothschild that would finance the French Revolution on behalf of the Jesuit order.
May I stop you there?
Sure.
Adam Weishaupt, does he just get an idea one day he's going to do this? Was there somebody behind the scenes or something?
No. The Jesuit general, he was under orders. According to Nesta Webster, who was a Roman Catholic historian, and she wrote Secret Societies and Subversive Movements, she said that Weishaupt was not acting alone.
Okay.
And the same thing was said by Lady Queenborough in her Occult Theocracy, that Weishaupt was not acting alone but under orders. Well, he could only be under orders from the Jesuit general.
Before we go to the connection with Rothschild, mm-hmm. may I ask you this? One time, again, on the web, I kicked up some site that spoke about Weishaupt. It was in German. I had somebody translate it. And what it seemed to be saying was that at some time, did he fall out of favor and start another branch, more or less? Or what was going on there?
No. See, one of the things that the Jesuits have done is they've penetrated conspiratorial history so as to make it look that the Illuminati was not connected to the Jesuit order. So if you read Robinson's work, Proofs of a Conspiracy, and some others, it will tell you that Weishaupt was discredited. He left the Jesuit order. He was no longer in the Jesuit order, but he used the principles and tactics of the Jesuit order in the establishment of the Illuminati. That's typical conspiratorial history. Well, the fact is Weishaupt never left the Jesuit order. He died in the mid-1800s, and like in 1830s or so on. He was faithful unto death. There's no evidence that he ever left the order, and the order benefited by everything the Bavarian Illuminati did, specifically the French Revolution, when the Jesuits used Robespierre, who had been trained by Jesuits in the College of Louis le Grand, to lead the fanatical Jacobins to behead thousands of people. And according to one of the sons of Maria Theresa, the Jesuits were always up front at the guillotining of their enemies. So the Jesuits benefited by what the Bavarian Illuminati fomented and caused.
So Weishaupt never then was in exile, more or less?
Never. Never.
Was he at all in communication with Thomas Jefferson?
I'm not sure, but we do know that Jefferson was a wicked man, even though he advocated good principles like states' rights and limited powers. He was part of the Grand Orient Lodge in Paris that had incited the Jacobin revolt, along with Benjamin Franklin. And so I would not doubt that Jefferson, in connection with the French Grand Orient Lodge of Paris, may have had some contact with Weishaupt and may have had some contact with Jesuit General Ritchie if he had survived and not been killed in 1775, as we're told. But nonetheless, Jefferson could not advocate the principles of the Illuminati because he was surrounded by too many decent and good men in America.
There's a website off the top of my head on which I read. It's a book online, more or less, and it talked about, and this was a loaded question, I have to confess, Brother Eric.
That's okay.
With Jefferson and Weishaupt being in a communication, the result of which being the design of the dollar bill.
Okay. You mean the seal?
Oh, the backside, sure.
The seal. Yeah, the seal was no doubt a part of the Jesuit effect of the outcome of the revolution, but the seal was not used for a long, long time until FDR put that seal on the dollar bill in 1933. And the putting of that seal, the all-seeing eye of the Black Pope on that seal, was an indication to all the brethren in the secret societies that they had now complete and total control of America, and it was just simply a matter of time that they would have control of the world, being in control of the military of the United States. So Jefferson, I have no doubt he was an evil man, because he wrote the Jefferson Bible. And what did he do? The first three Gospels, he cut out everything that was supernatural. Cut out all the miracles of Christ, cut out his virgin birth, cut out his resurrection, cut out all of it, the first three Gospels. And that Jefferson Bible was brought into the Congress by Theodore Roosevelt. So he was not a good man, but and he may very well have had connection with Weishaupt in some way, but the Lord intervened and would not allow the American Revolution to become what the French Revolution was, because there were too many Bible-believing Calvinists that were praying and fighting for right and fighting for their individual liberty, because of which they had been oppressed for 200 years in Europe, and for which reason the vast majority came to this country.
You've mentioned the worship of Baal. We've talked about Luciferianism, Osiris. What is the connection between, if there is, between the Jesuits and Freemasons?
The Jesuit order, well, back in, 1312, Clement V suppressed the Knights Templars and burned Jacques de Molay at the stake. Well, the Knights Templars went to Scotland, and they stayed underground and fought with Robert the Bruce. But later, in 1717, the Knights Templars were formally revived in England with a grandmother lodge of Freemasonry, and that Freemasonry, which was modern-day Knights Templarism, was used to primarily paganize and attack the white Protestant nations of Europe and reduce them back to the papacy. And their focal point of attack was England, because if they could conquer England, they could conquer the entire Reformation. So, yes, the Jesuits did revive Freemasonry. According to my own Masonic authors here, that the Jesuits wrote the first 25 degrees of the Scottish Rite in the College of Clermont in 1754. And then the Jesuits wrote the last 8 degrees when they were being protected by Frederick the Great in Prussia when he died in 1786. So all of the rites, all of the initiates of the first 33 degrees, the Jesuits had a hand in it. And I have another quote on that written in Charles Sutherland in, 1877. He said, "The sons of Loyola all had a hand in all of these rites." So the Jesuits revived Freemasonry, and they have used Freemasonry as their tool to subordinate nations and ultimately to have them serve the Vatican.
Well, Freemasonry got a pretty good toehold in the United States prior to, I guess, during and after the Revolution.
Well, the Freemasonry in the United States, according to George Washington, when he wrote his famous letter in 1798, he said that the Freemasonry in the United States generally had not been penetrated by the Order of the Illuminati, meaning that it had not been Jesuitized yet. Now, that's in a letter that I have quoted in my book. And he also said that he did not go into Masonic Lodge for the last 30 years of his life. That's from 1768 to 1798 when he wrote the letter, but once or twice. So all these lies put forward by the Webb and all these Masons, that Washington was a master Mason, master of a lodge, actively involved in Freemasonry, is a lie. It's simply not true. It's just like the lie that Luther hated the Jews and wrote a book called The Jews and Their Lies. Luther never wrote such a thing. That was the last book ever attributed to him, and the Jesuits wrote it and attributed it to him. So no, Washington was not this high-level Freemason that we're all taught, and the American Freemasonry was not subverted yet by the Illuminati. That happened after the turn of the century when, in 1801, the Scottish Rite of the Southern Jurisdiction was set up in Charleston, and from then on it started to penetrate American Freemasonry, which ultimately led to the murder of Captain William Morgan up on the Niagara Gorge for disclosing the first 3 degrees in his book on Freemasonry. And then because he was murdered by the Freemasons, 50,000 Northern Masons seceded from the lodge. And those were in the 1820s, that's right.
Did they beget the Anti-Masonic Party?
And the Anti-Masonic Party began, that's right. In fact, Thaddeus Stevens partially headed that up. But it turns out that the Masons had penetrated the Anti-Masonic Party to create sympathy and so on, and ultimately then it just dissipates. But no, the Anti-Masonry movement was big in the country in the 1820s, 1830s, and it's interesting also that at the very same time there was the Second Great Awakening in our country at that time. First Great Awakening being with George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards in 1735, 1740, and the second being in the 1830s, around there, about the time of the Anti-Masonic movement.
A lot of Lincoln's comments come through in Vatican Assassins through the reminiscences of, is it Charles Chiniquy?
Yes, Charles Chiniquy, the ex-priest.
Okay. Now, through Chiniquy, he mentions that Lincoln actually speaks about the Jesuits, you know, as I know many people have spoken about Arab migration to this country, that they're all over the place. And was there an influx prior to the Civil War?
Oh, yes.
That was notable?
Oh, yes. See, the Jesuits were busy coming in the country, and they were bringing their fanatical Irish Roman Catholics over here. Because the two places that the Jesuits regarded as their great bastions of power were German Bavaria and Ireland. And so what they did was they forced the Irish Catholics to come over here. And one of the ways they did it was they caused what we know as the Irish Potato Famine in 1845. When the fact of the matter is that the Jesuits, with their evil Lord John Russell and Viscount Palmerston, they were busy starving the Irish. 7 freighters a day left the ports of Ireland for foreign ports loaded with meats and vegetables, which ultimately killed 1 million Irishmen and drove millions more to this country for food. Well, when the Jesuits got the Irish over here, they were busy to groom them and ultimately have them put in political office, and so that they would control the major cities of the north at that time. And remember, the Irish Catholics hated the blacks, so they did not want to go south. They went north, took over the major northern cities, and then the country was divided, primarily Catholic cities in the north and Protestants in the south.
I was going to ask you that. Do we know that the colonies basically were Protestant uniformly from Rhode Island on down to Georgia?
Absolutely.
In the beginning?
That is very common knowledge. If you read Bancroft's History of the United States, his 10-volume set, the first 3 volumes deal with that, especially Volume 3, and also John Clark Ridpath's World History, or Universal History. All the colonies, all 13 colonies, were Protestant. They were, all 3 million people, the vast majority of them, nearly all of them were Protestant. There were 300,000 Roman Catholics, no, 30,000 Roman Catholics, 1% was Catholic, 30,000, and there were 24 priests, according to Jeremiah Crowley, who was probably the Martin Luther of the early part of the 20th century when he wrote Romanism, A Menace to the Nation. So the country was absolutely Protestant, and it was filled with Protestant immigrants and refugees from Europe. They were being killed out of Europe by the Jesuits, so they came here.
But then that did change at a point when Roman Catholic Irish were more or less forced out. You're saying it was a plot, no doubt.
That's right. It was a plot to get them all here.
And direct it to the northeast.
And to the northeast, where we now have this northeast power, political power here, which is for the most part in the hands of Irish Roman Catholics. And so they brought them there. They groomed them. They brought them to a place of political power. And ultimately, the war, the purpose for the American war between the states was to destroy as many Protestants as they could, particularly white Southern Protestants, to destroy the Protestant South, which it was a war of annihilation after Gettysburg, because Lee could have been defeated by Roman Catholic General Meade had not a Jesuit secretly come to his tent and tell him to let Meade escape, to let Lee escape, and so Meade let him escape, and then Archbishop Hughes fomented the riots in New York and drew off one quarter of Meade's army to quell the riots so they couldn't chase Lee. So it became a war of annihilation after Gettysburg, and then after that war of annihilation, where General Sherman burned 2,000 barns and destroyed 60 grain mills in the beautiful Shenandoah Valley, then they put them under Reconstruction, under martial law, till they would ratify the 14th Amendment. So the purpose was to destroy the Baptist, Protestant, Presbyterian, Calvinist South, and then on that ruins bring in millions of more Irish and Italian and French immigrants to settle the major cities, control the political parties like Tammany Hall in New York, control both parties ultimately, and then use the American 14th Amendment America to wage its many, many wars, foreign wars, for the benefit of the papacy.
Now, I skip by the connection with the House of Rothschild, but I want to bring it back here because Britain also was provocateuring during the Civil War.
Right.
Britain is obviously always associated with the House of Rothschild.
Right.
With the Jesuits. Was this an attempt also where Britain sees its chance? Well, Rothschilds make money.
Right.
And Britain seizes its chance to further eviscerate the colonies that had bolted from them.
Right. See, this is when England got back the colonies, because the Jesuits were ruling England, and so one of the benefits for the English nobles was to get back the colonies via the 14th Amendment. So at the time of the war, it was Lord John Russell who was the foreign minister, and he was a Jesuit. And so he was favoring the North. He would not help the South. The Spanish, the English, and the French were secretly on the side of the North. If the South was supposedly backed by the Pope, was what we're told, because of the letter that the Pope wrote to Jefferson Davis after Gettysburg, a letter which would never have been written prior if Gettysburg would have been lost to the North, or to the South, that Napoleon III could have easily been ordered to aid the South, but he wasn't. England could have easily been told to aid the South, but it wasn't. England wanted the ruination of the South, along with France, our ancient friends, to whom we owe our liberty, because they had expelled the Jesuits and gave us the wonderful Marquis de Lafayette to help us in our war, and also Spain. So those three countries, at the time of the American War between the states, were anti-freedom and under the control of the Jesuit order.
And did we not also have Russia involved in this?
Sure.
To
Russia
back up the North?
Provided the blockades in San Francisco and New York to keep the blockade runners of the South from running their guns and so on. And Russia at this time was under the Tsar, I believe was Alexander II. And I think Alexander II thought he was doing right. Mm-hmm. Alexander II emancipated the serfs, some 4 million serfs. He sought to propose a constitution for Russia. He did everything that the Jesuits hated in Russia, which is why they murdered him with the Nihilists when they blew him to bits. But Alexander and the Hohenzollern of Germany and the Metternichs of Austria, the Habsburgs of Austria, were the heart of the Holy Alliance, and the Holy Alliance was against American liberty and viewed that war as the agency by which they would reduce it again to the control of England and thus the Vatican.
One other question, if you're aware of this, or you confirm this or not, about other nations willing to pitch in during the Civil War. Have you ever heard, read anything with regard to French troops actually offloading in Mexico and ready to go?
Yes, that's correct.
It did happen, didn't it?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
The French, it's actually, see, when Benito Juarez, the great Benito Juarez, God bless his soul, took power, he expelled the Archbishop of Mexico, he expelled the bishops, he expelled as many priests as he could, he refused to pay back the national debt to England, of Mexico, for which reason England, Spain, and France invaded. So England was called off, Spain was called up, but the French remained, and Maximilian assumed the dictatorship of Mexico until he was executed, I believe, in 1867. But at that time, there were French troops in Mexico, and all the people of the south were of the north were told, listen, the French are going to unite with the Confederates, and they're going to come up, and they're going to destroy our country. So Lincoln rightfully expelled the French out of Mexico, told them to leave, and then Maximilian was executed. But that's not what would have happened. If the French were going to help the Confederates, they could have easily done it at the beginning of the war. But they did not.
Well, there's a book printed by a press at the school for which I work. I believe the gentleman's name is Bela Hovak. I'm not sure. It's called Divided We Fall. And it talks basically about, in terms that do not deal, obviously you're not going to get that out of a Catholic press, okay, about Jesuits, that it was just very poor Southern diplomacy that did not get the French to jump in.
Oh, no. Not at all. All the Pope had to do, all Pius IX would have to do, was to wave his hand to Napoleon III. Because remember, Napoleon was the president of the Second Republic. There was a coup d'etat brought about by the Jesuits. He was made emperor of the Second Empire. Now, as emperor of the Second French Empire, which he was the head of for somewhat 18 years, from 1852 to 1871, defeated at Sedan by the Germans, he could have easily set sail to give the Confederates aid and comfort if the Pope wanted that, because he was the absolute creation of Pope Pius IX. But the Pope didn't want that. The Jesuit general did not want that. They wanted the South to fall, and it had nothing to do with bad Southern diplomacy.
Well, we'll get back to Lincoln's assassination, but here we have Lincoln assassinated. The Civil War is over. The South is crushed.
Right.
And the 14th Amendment, through the humiliation of the Reconstruction Acts directed toward the South, the 14th Amendment gets passed. What's the big deal about the 14th Amendment?
The 14th Amendment is the coup d'etat. It's not the killing of Kennedy that's the coup d'etat. The 14th Amendment is the coup d'etat, when they created a whole new government with a whole new set of powers, and they converted what was once our Calvinist Protestant Republic into a Jesuit empire, which I call in my book the Pope's Holy Roman 14th Amendment American Empire.
What does it do to this? I'm sorry, if you want to continue with that.
No, we can continue if you want.
Oh, no, what I want to know is, what is the impact upon citizens today?
Okay. Well, what the 14th, to answer that question, I must tell you what the 14th Amendment did.
Exactly.
What it did was, is it reversed, in the words of the Supreme Court, it reversed the origin and character of American citizenship. It made U.S. citizenship primary, and it made state citizenship subordinate to that. So it was state citizenship was subordinate and derivative, quote-unquote. U.S. citizenship was, quote, paramount and dominant. And then the Supreme Court in 1872 slaughtered our status when it said that the privileges and immunities of 14th Amendment citizenship do not include fundamental rights. Later that was more fully defined in Twining versus New Jersey in 1907 and Maxwell versus Dow in 1899. Those rights were the Bill of Rights. So, American citizenship, the privileges of American citizenship under the 14th Amendment do not include the Bill of Rights. Before the 14th Amendment, they did include the Bill of Rights, and Justice Harlan is very clear in his dissent in Maxwell versus Dow about that. So, what it means is all we have are privileges and immunities granted from the federal government. We are servants, we are slaves of the federal government. Blacks and whites are all equal on the same status now. We're all slaves of the federal government. We have no rights that the federal government is restricted to violate. All we have are privileges and immunities. And this is the exact same citizenship that existed in the Roman Empire under Caracalla when he extended citizenship to everybody, which further destroyed the empire pursuant to Gibbon's decline and fall of the Roman Empire.
And one other thing, perhaps this is the way I interpret it, as a harbinger of the income tax to come in 1913. Didn't it also make American citizens good for picking up the tab that was run up by the District of Columbia?
Of course, because now the District of Columbia, which is called in 1888, I have a book with this title by Justin Fulton, Rome on the Potomac. Rome on the Potomac now could spend money on anything they wanted to. They were not limited by the Constitution and the 17 things they could spend money on. And so now they could spend money, and then the American citizen, 14th Amendment citizen, could now be forced to pay this tax. And, of course, Lincoln was the first one to come out with the heavy progressive graduated income tax, which then was done away with, but then brought back in, attempted back in 1895, and then ultimately brought it back in 1913. But they communized our country. The Jesuits were the masters of communism. They perfected communism on their Jesuit reductions in Paraguay. They tutored Marx in the British Museum. And so they used this Masonic Jew to blame communism on, when really communism is the brainchild of the Jesuit order. They implemented all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto here in the United States, including a central bank and a heavy and progressive graduated income tax.
And on that note, we're going to bring segment 3 to a close. Before we do so, though, again, Eric, can you tell people how to get in contact with you and how to purchase the book, Vatican Assassins?
Okay. If you wish to purchase Vatican Assassins, Wounded in the House of My Friends, you may call Wisdom Books and Press at 1-877-280-2866. That's 1-877-280-2866. And if you wish to contact, you can view my website at vaticanassassins.org. Or you can email if you wish, as you see on the site, at eric@vaticanassassins.org.
And as I've stated, they can access your website through pascoradio.org, hit visit links, and then hit Vatican Assassins Brother Eric, and that'll get you to the website. All right, Eric, if you can stay with us for our fourth and last segment.
I'd be happy to.
It's really getting good now as we bring ourselves to present-day politics.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Who controls the British crown? Who keeps the metric system down? We do. We do.
Who leaves Atlantis off the maps?
Who keeps the Martians under wraps?
We do. We do. Who holds back the electric car? Who makes the Gutenberg a star?
Fish of their sight.
Who rigged every Oscar night?
We do. We do.
From the Grassy Knoll is a production of Dade City Community Radio. You are encouraged to broadcast this program on grassroots, non-commercial stations. From the Grassy Knoll can be heard along with other non-mainstream programming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, by going to live365.com and search on Dade City. You may also hear archived programs in real audio by visiting pascoradio.org. Comments may be directed to info@pascoradio.org. From the Grassy Knoll and Dade City Community Radio, I'm Dr. Swain.